I think this is your first time showing in Slovenia, I suppose. Am I right?
Actually not, but this is the first major presentation of my work. I've been participating in some video festival and in some minor show, but this is the first.
Like solo show.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like some kind of overview of your recent work of last few years. So what are you showing tonight?
I'm showing three pieces that span from a couple of years. I'm showing one sound piece, one video installation, and one photographic work.
Mm-hmm. So three different medias.
Yeah.
On purpose, probably.
It fitted together well for this exhibition. And
so usually you're combining like sound and picture in your works. It's usually used as some kind of metaphor. So are you avoiding like the direct messages in your work?
I think if the only goal with my art were to debate, to make political statements, then probably art is not even the most clear choice of media.
Mm-hmm.
There is of course an interest in visual and aesthetic levels that is very relevant for me, and that's why I'm an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But then I like to work with things that concern me, and one of these things are copyright issues and how multinational companies are fiercely trying to get complete control over our society.
So with all the facts about copyright, I mean, somehow it's impossible to control. So the, like you said, the big companies are always inventing some kind of new ways to persuade people to pay for some copyrights or to not use something. When did you start working on that? Because this copyrights issue is changing all the time. Mm. So where was your starting point with that?
Actually, I have a background within music, not as a maker of music, but I've been a collector of obscure music, and I've been working in a record shop for many years. That's sort of my point into where I got interested in how situations have changed for development of music. Genres like jazz and even classical music, blues, rock, have totally been created by borrowing and recreating, transforming other stuff from folk music and other genres. And these genres wouldn't possibly be able to exist today were it not for artistic freedom, usage of other material, and combining into new ways. That's my starting point, noticing how, if you will, we only have to go back to the early 90s with hip-hop and trip-hop bands like Portishead, Public Enemy. What they did then wouldn't be possible to do today without having major record labels behind you. That's also why you nowadays hear samples from the same song over and over in a song, and then if you do a little bit of research, you figure out that the sampled artists usually belong to the same record label as the artist sampling. So it's not, I mean, the creative aspect in this has transformed into commercialism. Let's earn money on this song another time, second time rather.
How much these things changed from early 90s? When did it start? I mean, in such a sense to use this terminology of copyrights.
But of course it's much earlier. There has been battles between radio and live musicians. There has been battles when the cassette format appeared. Then record labels feared that this would destroy music, since everybody would be copying. And but then they mm-hmm. put a tax on cassettes, and they put a tax on all the media that has been possible to use to copy something with. But it's still being fought, basically because there's lots of money in it. But it's also a bigger issue. It's the same rules are also used to get control over crops. In India, there was an American company who managed to get control over basmati rice, because they managed to get patent on basmati rice by genetically manipulating the rice and then spreading it. And they had created a rice that is so much stronger, so it spreads into other crops. So even if you're not actively growing this rice, it will infiltrate your crop and take over. So after a while, you will be growing their copyrighted basmati rice, and therefore you have to pay for them. So Indian farmers were supposed to pay to Rice Tech in Texas for growing rice. So it's a bigger issue than just music industry. It's
maybe music is the metaphor for all these bigger issues. Exactly. With your work.
It's the most obvious for people in Europe and the Western world, because here we have it decently well, and but we notice when these things are being fought, and it's very obvious for us. And it's used, as you say, it's a point in to discuss a bigger field. This is something everybody know about. Everybody know about the discussions about copyright downloading and pirating. And
your work, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of stolen silence, is dealing with that. So about copyrights. So in this concrete case, you're stating that silence is not existing. But is it possible to copyright the silence?
As it is nowadays. Every second of recorded material on a CD issued by a record label is copyrighted. If there's within the composition is a pause, then the pause is part of the composition, and therefore it's copyrighted. The whole recording, except the pauses between the songs, then that is copyrighted. And it's of course an absurdity and playing with the edges of the reasonable, but since it's now impossible to legally, without paying for it, borrow a single second of recorded material. This is just taking it to the absurdity. And what I've done is to cut out breaks, pauses within songs, and cut it together to a composition that has the same length as John Cage classic piece 433. That was piece where a pianist sat quietly in front of a piano for the duration of 4 minutes and 33 seconds. But here it is, of course, not silent. Now when I've cut away all the music around, it's possible to crank up the volume way beyond where the speakers would bear before, so you're able to hear things behind the background hiss, like lingering tones and somebody moving in the space, or just different layers of electronic hum from the recording equipment, and that is what is actually being heard in the piece.
But this is not, I would say, against the copyright law. I mean, you avoided this somehow with this or not?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's sort of more joking or toying or teasing with the law, because of course nobody would ever be able to identify their silence and claim any rights for it. So it's of course more a way of touching upon the subject, but with a sort of jokingly or so, at the same time creating a composition that I think is interesting.
So what about if we go to visual arts? So visual arts are the field when referring is something completely normal, so it's almost impossible to abandon or forbid to use the footages or paintings from the past. How is it with visual art? How is it organized? I mean, is there any specific law with copyrights in visual art here?
There is, of course there is. It only matters to the extent of where somebody who cares actually get to see it. If you're painting Mickey Mouse and Walt Disney Company gets to see it, then you might have problem. But if you're painting Mickey Mouse and exhibiting in a local gallery far away from Disney Corporation, of course nothing will happen. But now, of course, laws vary from country to country, but in general the law in the EU countries are fairly similar now, and it's basically always up to who have the most money. In Sweden there's been several cases of photographers and different companies trying to process against artists who have painted using a photography or something. So far it has always ended in favor for the artist, but in Canada and US there's been the opposite happening. So
Bunny Project is like another metaphor for these copyrights and everything. So can you? I think you're not showing it here.
There will be a temporary visit during the opening of the Bunny from the Bunny project, but it will only be here over the opening.
Okay, and this project was based on, I would say, I mean, it's ongoing project with different actions. So can you tell something more about that?
Yeah, it started out with me on a very personal level, just thinking, noticing how many situations in my life, like important situations, love affairs, a friend who killed himself, different situations of personal value. There was these images of rabbits. One person had a tattoo of a rabbit, one other person was making small sculptures of rabbits, and it was just start dawning on me that this is just kind of absurd how these rabbits keep popping up everywhere. So then, instead of being rational, I decided to be the opposite of being rational, being paranoid. So I just decided, okay, there is something here. So I started studying the phenomenon of the rabbit, both in culture history and zoology, and like learning about the rabbit and seeing how it's used in art history and all kinds of ways. And during these studies, I stumbled upon the fact that the northliest population of European wild rabbit is the regular grey rabbit, lives in a place called Hisingen, that is just north of the town I was living in Sweden back then. So I was just a couple of kilometers from the northliest population of wild rabbits, so I decided I have to go find them. So I went on this sort of safari, and in the end I discovered traces of rabbits and they dig holes like at a golf course. And this was just there sort of where the project started, because obviously I had to encourage these rabbits. They were digging tunnels on the golf course, undermining the golf course. Golf, of course, being an upper-class entertainment, foremostly. So these rabbits became some kind of a symbol for underground resistance. If they have good living conditions, they multiply very quickly and then can totally dominate an area. When they were imported to Australia for hunting purposes in the 19th century, and let loose on some of the English landlords' properties, they multiplied to 10,000 in a couple of years and became a nationwide problem, and had like destroyed parts of Australia, turned it into desert basically, and many species has been died out and everything. So finding these rabbits on this golf course, of course I have to help them, so I started putting out carrots there to encourage them to continue their underground resistance and destroying the golf course. So there, that was sort of maybe kind of the center and core of the project, and it has then developed into different stories and different.
I read about your carrot bumps.
Yeah,
it was quite. It was quite a bizarre situation, but in fact, really provocative in Sweden.
Yeah. It was a gallery. I have the first done this piece a couple of times, and once it was done during the inauguration of a new art museum in a Swedish city, and I was invited to do a performance where I make these bunches of carrots and put alarm clocks and red and blue wires on them, making them sort of this caricature. Cartoon bombs, dynamite packs, like in Roadrunner movies or Bugs Bunny movies or something such, and placing them out around the museum. And then at the inauguration of the museum, the culture minister was supposed to speak, and she refused to hold her speech if my performance was allowed to continue. So the Swedish secret police informed me that I had to leave the premises, even though I was invited by the gallery to do it. Another museum commissioned me a year later, having heard this story, commissioned me to do it for an open art festival in another Swedish city. And they were in contact with the police in advance, informing the police, showing pictures of this, how these carrots looked like. But during the opening, the police still decided to confiscate some of the sculptures, and there was the possibility of charges being put against the museum, but yeah, the city museum that was arranging the whole thing, and nothing more happened. I got the carrots back a couple of weeks later, a bit funny looking, but they're preserved in alcohol now, so they become objects with the police assistance in creating this new art piece. And so this,
so proofs, yeah, something so, like
exactly,
that.
Yeah.
So about the work, and I need to read that because I'm usually failing. It's desensitizer. Desensitizer, yeah.
It's a word that has caused many person problem, including me. Even I have noticed that I misspell it sometimes. But yes, desensitizer.
Desensitizer. So it's a little bit special in your work because it's not exactly dealing with like copyrights, but it's dealing with the media, with the mass media, with the I don't know, propaganda. All those keywords are coming to my head. So it's a piece with a series of still photos from the violent movies. What is your message with that?
It's stills from violent scenes in violent movies that I've cut out and pasted together to a 10-minute long sequence. Every second has 24 images, feature movies. So it goes so the images pass by so quickly, so you can't distinguish the individual images. And this is alluding back to the myth about subliminal messages in movies and the experiments that Coca-Cola was making during the 50s, where they placed frames of "buy Coca-Cola" or Coca-Cola bottles and such inside movies to see whether this could get people to buy more Coca-Cola. So it's alluding to that thing, and at the same time discussing entertainment violence. Around 1980, beginning of 80s, was a big debate in UK and also in Sweden, and so, and lots of violent movies were forbidden. And these movies, most of them has been allowed again now, but it's notable that what is shown on in average cinemas today is much, much more violent than these movies that was forbidden back then. So it has, it's obviously when I'm cutting these stills, I notice how newer movies. And then I go to the average Tarantino movies, much more violent than movies like Cannibal Holocaust, Zombie Flesh Eaters, these movies that are made to be shocking and grotesque back in the late 70s, early 80s. That the amount of violence, which I notice when I'm now actually saving the violent scenes, it's much more in common entertainment movies today.
And is there any, I would say, my first reference when I was reading this, I mean, the description of the project was Clockwork Orange,
yeah.
Like how to heal the violent guy with the violence. Did you have this in mind?
It's of course an obvious reference, whilst, I mean, the debate usually goes in the other direction, that seeing violence numbs you, so you're less caring, rather than that you be repulsed by the act. So that is an obvious, but it's an obvious reference with being strapped down in front of a display of an enormous amount of violence. Then the other movie that has functioned as inspiration is The Marathon Man, I think is the English title of it, the Dustin Hoffman movie, where he is being interrogated and tortured in the dentist chair.
That's why the chair.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite convinced that Malcolm McDowell was strapped into a dentist chair in the scene in Clockwork Orange until I re-saw it, and I realized it was actually in a small cinema, and it's just strapped down to one of the cinema chairs. But these two are still the movies that sort of, yeah, inspired the way of presenting this piece.